Shrink Wrap Radio Number 10, October 28, 2005. Interview with Bert Kaplan on psychology, insight meditation, Buddhism, and art. Hey there, everyone. This is David Van Nuys, otherwise known as Dr. Dave, coming to you once again from the beautiful wine country in Sonoma County, California. Shrink Wrap Radio is the podcast addressed to your secret inner psychologist. It is born of my own heart and soul and my long experience in the psychological profession. Through the window of interviews with folks in and around the helping professions generally and psychology in particular, I bring you windows into new vistas. As I like to say, all the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you a little bit dangerous. Today's interview is with my longtime friend, Bert Kaplan. Bert and I first met as graduate students. I won't say when. Let's just say long, long ago in a far, far away land. He ended up dropping out of grad school just short of completing his doctoral work. In his own special way, though, he is still very much engaged in psychological work, particularly the inner work of a longtime meditator and artist. Over the years that I've known Bert, I've watched him ripen into a very warm, attentive, compassionate, and wise man. As for many of us, psychedelic drugs played an important role in his early awakening, and he openly discusses that period in this interview. I hope you won't be turned off by this. While we mostly hear about the potential for the abuse of these substances, they nevertheless, for some, contributed to an awakening that later flowered into a deeper sense of our spiritual nature, the anti-war movement, the environmental movement, new directions in music and art, and various forms of political activism. Neither Bert nor I advocate the use of drugs. At the same time, we can't deny the role they played in an earlier era of our lives. So, here's the interview. Okay, well, I'm in the studio today with my good friend, Bert Kaplan. So, Bert, originally you planned to be a psychologist, and you went all the way through the coursework of a doctoral program, and then you got out. I'd like to go through some of that history with you. First of all, when did you first know you wanted to be a psychologist? What was it that drew you to the field?
Well, I would have to say, talk about my experience with drugs, particularly with LSD, which was...
Okay, we're going to get right into the nitty-gritty here, huh?
Yes, that seems to be an answer to your question.
Okay.
I can recall that time when I was in college in the 60s, in the early 60s, rather bewildered about my direction in life. And I had started smoking some pot. People were starting to do that, although it was not in the early 60s. It was not very prevalent at all. But the man I had been scoring some pot from, small amounts, came up to me one day and said, "Bert, if you like smoking this dope, you'll love this stuff." And he handed me a couple of sugar cubes, LSD sugar cubes. This was, I think, 1960. And a couple of nights later, my friend and I took this stuff in a friend's apartment, and we spent the next 36 hours really high on acid. And it went from a very beautiful, inspiring to very ugly and frightening, particularly towards the end when it just wouldn't stop. You know, couldn't get to sleep, and it wouldn't end. It finally did, but it was a very powerful experience, needless to say. And
somehow this leads into your deciding to major in psychology at some point?
Directly, yes. Yeah. Well, it was a direct experience from that. I experienced myself, my life, my world. It completely shattered my worldview.
Yeah.
And anything I thought I knew before that time, I wasn't so sure of anymore. Uh-huh. And I really wanted to explore what I had gotten a glimpse of. And I thought that through psychology, I could really come to know that land that I had glimpsed on this drug. So I started taking psychology courses.
Where was this?
This was at Brooklyn College.
Right, and we met actually while you were in a master's program at the University of Montana, and I was there at that same time. That's where you and I met. But how is it that you ended up in Montana?
Well, to be honest, let's see. Harvard wasn't exactly knocking on my door. My GPA was not all that great. I had been through Montana. A friend of mine, in fact, the same man that I took the LSD with, we had hitchhiked around the country. My first time out of New York, and we hitchhiked through Montana, through just amazing states in the country. And I just fell in love with Montana. And I knew if the opportunity arose, I would like to live there for some time.
Okay.
So the University of Montana accepted me and decided to go out there. It was just going to be a year for a master's program.
Okay, great. And then I was a year ahead of you while we were at Montana. I'd already been in the master's program for a year at that time. So then when I graduated, I took off from Montana for the University of Michigan while you were still there finishing up your MA program. And then I believe Montana developed a doctoral program sometime after I left that you stayed on for after your MA. Is that right?
I guess by this time I realized I wanted to pursue it further. And I liked living in Montana. I did not like living in New York, I realized. So I decided to stay on and enrolled in the PhD program and spent the next 6 years or so.
Wow, 6 years.
Yes.
Yep. And, you know, I have a number of friends who started out in graduate school but didn't finish up for one reason or another. And I know that life has a way of throwing up various obstacles and alternatives. What can you tell us about your reasons for not finishing up, given that you've done all the coursework and I guess you just had the dissertation research left?
Yes, and I was well on my way with working with a dissertation. It's interesting. Here again, just what got me started and got me out of it, LSD. I really hadn't fooled around with LSD. It had been a very scary experience that first time. I knew I was going to do it again, but it wasn't until I guess this is 1969, after being in Montana for 6 years. And by this time, drugs were much more common, and it seemed like everybody, even in Missoula, Montana, was smoking dope and doing acid, and I started doing it again, and fairly often at this point.
I need to insert that Dr. Dave does not advocate the use of drugs.
Yeah, that's a whole separate issue. I don't advocate them either. I would say, though, in my case, in this particular instance, at that time and place, it was what I needed to do, and it was very beneficial in my life. But my whole worldview, again, was changed, and I came to realize that my reasons for being in the PhD program were not really my own. That I, in the insights under the influence of this drug, I realized what I was doing was in large part what my mother had wanted me to do, to become a doctor, become a professional, a Jewish mother's dream.
Right.
And a large part of my work there was to fulfill her goals, not mine, as well as the realization that I really was not getting the understanding into myself that I wanted, that I had originally entered the program for. So.
Ah, very interesting. And that really probably leads into the central topic of our conversation, which has to do with your experiences in the practice of Buddhist meditation. And so I'm assuming that, why don't you tell me about how your path led to the practice of meditation? What brought that about? It was sometime, I guess, after Montana, after you were out of graduate school, had decided to drop out I guess you came to California.
Yes, I came to California for various reasons. Just came to visit, actually, and ended up never leaving. I had heard the word meditation in those years of drugs. A friend of mine had started to meditate, and I remember the moment I heard that term. I was very influenced by it, and it struck me, and I knew at some point in my life I would turn to that, although it took many years, not until I think it was 1987 when I met my first teacher, Ishwaran, that I really was able to learn how to meditate and began to do it on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. And so what impact did that have on your life in terms of, you know, you mentioned that you wanted to come to a fuller knowing of yourself and that you had thought that you would find that in psychology, but in some ways psychology disappointed you. You know, what's been the impact of Buddhist thought, philosophy, and meditation on your life?
Yeah, wow, that's a complex question, complex answer, but trying to be brief, my initial response with Ishwaran was very powerful, as much though as the LSD, and I had another round of transformation in my life. I pretty soon gave up all drugs, drinking, smoking, and really tried to purify myself under his guidance and started meditating on a regular basis and started to, after a while, really get a sense of myself. It's a very complex process. And it involved also, after a number of years, moving on to another form of meditation that I more practice now, Vipassana, associated with Spirit Rock Center in Woodacre, California, where I started to do long, long retreats.
Well, meditation is an Eastern approach to exploring the inner world. And in the West, we've developed counseling and psychotherapy as ways of exploring the inner world. What do you see as the interplay between counseling slash therapy and meditation?
I think there's a very strong interplay. I've tried in my life to explore anything I felt that would lead to what I consider to be my life purpose, my life goal, if I can use those phrases, to understand myself, figure out just what I'm doing here, why I'm here. And I found some degree of answers in both areas. Psychotherapy, I would say, more helps with the day-to-day difficulties in living on the more physical plane, mm-hmm. whereas the meditation, of course, these are broad generalities, but meditation helps on a more spiritual aspect. I want to pursue...
In terms of... try to ground this more in your own life experience for me, if you will. I mean,
yes.
What issues in your life did counseling or therapy help you with, and what issues have meditation helped you with?
Well, to go back a little bit, in my life, my early days of my life as a youth, I had I saw myself with a lot of fairly serious problems. I was a troubled person. I dealt with a lot of depression, fairly serious depression, and really feelings of low feelings of self-esteem and self-worth, and struggled with these for many years. It's hard to separate the two, you know, when I really think about it, but the meditation was very effective in coming to see myself in a more realistic light and being able to let go of a lot of the self-judgment, the self-criticalness, and coming to accept myself as I was. Mm-hmm. This is, I think, one of the major teachings in Buddhism that I value so much.
Yeah, psychology, too, talks about self-esteem. You know, there have been lots of books written about self-esteem, and that's important. And yet somehow in the meditation, and maybe the therapy and the counseling you had helped in the self-esteem area, I don't know. It sounds like the meditation gave you some kind of perspective, gave you some distance from yourself, or how would you describe it?
Yeah, I think that's a good phrase. Certainly some distance, some basic principles of guidance in my life, one of which is to not take it so seriously, that it's not all that serious, it's not all about me, mm-hmm. These kinds of things. I'm not in control, really, to the extent that I thought I was.
Yeah,
and
that
life, to see life more in terms of a process rather than some kind of a product or goal-oriented, and to try to relax and enjoy the moment. Of course, these things are easier said than done. But through the practice of meditation, I think there's something in that practice itself, particularly on long retreats for me, that allowed my body to actually incorporate these principles and learn to live by them on a more intuitive basis.
I know in recent years you've gone off on a number of these retreats that I've been aware of, where you've gone off for 10 days at a
mm-hmm.
time.
Yeah.
And I gather there's very little talking, if any, other than maybe the teacher who has these sort of the breaks during which there's some kind of inspirational talk or
mm-hmm.
guidance
yes.
talk is yeah. given. But the rest of the time is spent pretty much in silence, isn't it?
Yes, yes. It's a most amazing experience. Try to do them for 10 days. It's about as much as I can spare from the rest of my life at this point. But they've been so powerful, so rich. The silence is so much. The silence. They are done in silence, as you say, except for these talks, these Dharma talks, where the teacher will discuss things in the evening that we're going through. But to sit there in periods of alternating sitting meditation and walking meditation and spending 6, 8, 10 hours a day in meditation, in silence, with no reading or TV, no telephone, just you're pretty much stuck with yourself.
Yeah. Now, I haven't done this. I flirt with the notion and have certainly been inspired to try it by you and other friends of mine who've gone on these retreats. As I project myself into it and imagine it, I imagine starting off with some sense of enthusiasm and energy, which would then transition into boredom.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It gets very boring.
Yeah. And that's where I get hung up.
I
generally flee from boredom
yeah.
and keep myself maybe excessively busy.
Yes. So there's a perfect example of what you're saying, David, how we deal with our life in general. We all tend to flee from boredom.
Mm-hmm.
The beauty of the retreat is you can't do it. You can't flee. There's nowhere to go.
Uh-oh.
So you got yes. So you're stuck. You got to sit there
yeah.
and bear with it. And it transforms. It really does. The first few days can be difficult. Most people find some degree of difficulty. But you reach a period, invariably I have, and I think most people in every retreat after the first few days, where things kind of seem to open up. You kind of go through a wall. You hit a wall and you go through it. And things kind of open up. And not to say it's all light and beauty after that, but you do experience a lot of light and a lot of beauty and a lot of joy, mm-hmm. as well as very often tremendous insights of personal as well as spiritual momentum. It's an amazing experience.
Well, I've seen a process of transformation in you over the years that I've known you.
Yes.
And probably through a mix of, I know there was some pretty intensive forms of therapy that you were
yes.
involved with in the early years after we got reunited. There was a long period during which Bert and I were separated. And then we kind of rediscovered each other, discovered that we were both in California by coincidence, both in Sonoma County, and we were able to pick up our friendship again. And we came together actually as fathers. We had known each other first as young men,
yes,
as very young men. And when we hooked up again later, the place that we really connected around was our love of our children,
yes,
and talking about that.
Yes.
So that was really important for us. And now I forgot where I was going with this. I remember now. So I've seen you evolve over the last years. And one of the things that happened in that evolution was a wonderful flowering as an artist. Because when I knew you in Montana, and even when I reconnected with you here in California, you weren't an artist. At least you weren't
right.
creating art. Something happened. And now you are, by my lights, a successful artist, somebody whose paintings are beautiful to behold and sell for good money. So yes. What happened?
There again, it's a complex question and many strands to that. But in one sense, I think the art is just a symptom, if I can use that phrase, of my general process of transformation that I've gone through over the years. This is something I had wanted to do all my life and drew early on in my life, but was so self-critical and so full of self-doubt that I could never give myself the chance to pursue it. And you have to, in art, you have to be bad in order to learn to be better.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I was well into this process, the so-called process of transformation, which I really do view it in my life, that at some point I was able to let go of a lot of the self-criticalness and not be so fearful of making mistakes and being bad. And I had a certain commitment where to I really wanted to do this. This is a love of my life, and I committed myself to do it, and I did it.
Yeah.
Well, I've come a long way, let's put it that way.
Yeah,
I'm very
yeah.
pleased with my progress in the field of art.
Yeah, as indeed you should be. What's your view of psychology today? I know you've been away from the formal study of psychology, per se, for a long time, but nevertheless, you did go through a rather long and rigorous training in psychology. Read lots of books, got mm-hmm. involved in research, were in training, I believe, to be a psychotherapist.
Yes.
So I'm wondering, you know, what's your view of psychology today, and where do you see that in relation to the place of Buddhist philosophy or Vipassana philosophy / meditation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, as you say, I've been away quite a bit from the field of psychology. From what I see, though, psychology itself has made a major transformation over the years and is much more involved with spiritual matters, which to me is essential. And I don't recall there being very much interest in that. I know the boys in California, but not much in Montana at all. That has grown tremendously, the spiritual aspects, the spiritual awareness in the field
right.
of psychology.
Yeah, there's a whole field that's emerged known as transpersonal
yes.
psychology, and
yes.
there are even doctoral programs which are devoted to transpersonal psychology. And if you had started out today in a doctoral program, you might have found something that was closer to what you were originally looking for.
Yes, yes.
Because I know when we were in that program in Montana, behaviorism kind of ruled
yes,
the day.
Right. Skinner.
Yeah, B.F. Skinner, and it was all about animal psychology
yes.
and so on, and not much to nurture the spirit.
Right, right, right. Today, I noticed that a lot of my teachers have been through periods of personal psychotherapy, and some of them, like Jack Kornfield, I believe are therapists themselves, or in their living as psychotherapists.
These are the people that you regard as spiritual teachers
yes.
that you're referring to.
Yes,
okay.
Jack Kornfield is one that comes to mind,
yeah.
the co-founder at Spirit Rock. It's been very important in my life during certain periods, been very helpful in my transformation process, undergoing personal psychotherapy.
Okay.
It's a little more difficult to talk about that, actually to separate the strands, mm-hmm. but at times that has been very important.
Okay. You know, one of the reasons I ask is because I'm sure that some of the people who are listening, who will listen to this session, may be struggling in their own lives with issues of depression, issues of being overly self-critical, and so on. So if there are any sort of insights that you can share or that they could glean from what you've said, you know, that would be of great benefit.
One of the main principles that I try to work with in myself, and I think I referred to this before, but this idea of opening up, of accepting what's going on in the moment, and not trying to fight it or flee from it or ignore it, but opening up to it as best I can, even if it's painful or difficult. And I think there's so much to learn that we do learn. Maybe we learn the most through these periods of difficulty, the darkness, periods
yeah.
of darkness.
Yeah.
And they're just as necessary in life as the periods of joy and sunshine. They're no fun. We don't want to experience them, but they're there.
Right.
And not to fight them so much, and to know that they, as a rule, don't last forever, and life is change, and things will change.
You're a husband, a father of two beautiful daughters, a businessman, we haven't talked about that, an artist, a psychologist, even if non-practicing at present, a Buddhist meditator, and somehow all of these threads have come together in who you are today. What have you learned in your life that you'd like to share with the audience who will listen to this show? Now, I know it's a little redundant of the previous question, but I'll give you another crack at it.
Well, one of the things, listening, even just listening to the question, realizing in my own life how rich my life has been and how tremendously grateful I am. I'm just tremendously grateful. I feel such gratitude for being able to explore these areas. Just becoming a family man, a husband and father has been such a major piece of my life. All of these things are just so rich. I think I've tried to just live my life according to my inner guide, to trust myself. I think maybe that's maybe a big piece to that I've learned, to be able to trust myself, that ultimately all the answers that I've searched for, whatever I found, has been within me. All the time, and to learn, and to try to continually learn, and to remember to look inside for those answers, for the most part.
Yeah. Is there a book or two, perhaps, that you would recommend for someone who wishes to learn more about the sorts of things that we've been talking about?
There are a few. There's many books. I used to be, and still am, a very books have been very important in my life. One of the older books that I recall, Stephen Levine, A Gradual Awakening. I remember being very struck by that book. Sir Ram Dass, all of his books have been just wonderful stuff. And I should mention also the books of Joseph Goldstein. His books have been very useful for me too.
Okay, great. Well, I think we've come to the end of our session, and I really want to thank you for being willing to share such deep and personal material. And a lot of the stuff that you shared comes from periods of your life that were painful, difficult, mm-hmm. challenging. And I appreciate your willingness to be candid and put that out there.
Well, thank you, David. I really enjoyed this. It's been fun for me.
Okay, that's the interview. I hope you found it interesting and maybe even inspiring. I received a couple more emails last week that I'd like to share with you. They suggest that Shrink Wrap Radio fills a variety of needs. You may recall in the previous podcast I read a letter from an undergraduate psychology major. So one audience segment would be students. This past week I received a letter from Adam Ronskovich, and I hope I said your name right, Adam. Felt like I muffed it. Adam's in Denver, and he teaches a high school advanced placement class in psychology. In fact, he puts out his own AP Psychology podcast as a way of communicating with and engaging his students. Among other things, Adam writes, "Maybe down the road we could work together via Skype or something. I know that my kids would really like talking to a real psychologist." So, Adam, if you're listening, I would be happy to be interviewed on your podcast or find other ways of collaborating. High school teachers of psychology is an audience segment I had not thought about when I first set out to do this. The next piece of email is especially meaningful to me because it is my hope that this show will be inspirational and will provide tools or directions that will be useful in listeners' lives. Gary sent the following email. "Dr. Dave, thank you. Over the past 2 days, I've listened to all 9 of your podcasts. I heard your promo on an AwareTech podcast and subscribed immediately. Your content is not only interesting and informative, but therapeutic for me. From the first one on intuition and dreams, I knew I had stumbled onto something that would help me in my recent transition, and then the most recent with Dr. Susan Stewart, really brought it all together. You see, this year I turned 50 and have been going through what I discovered to be a midlife crisis, depression, confusion. I left my wife of 15 years. I cry for 3 or 4 days at a time, looking for answers in books or on the internet, and even went to a psychiatrist for a few months. I particularly like the resources you provide with each podcast, books, and websites. I now have a very good list of books to read, and I'm sure I'll find my way. Keep up the good work. Thank you. Well, Gary, thank you so much for your heartfelt letter. It inspires me to keep up the podcast, and it confirms my desire to try to serve up some soul food in the process. I'd love to hear from other listeners. I know you're out there. They say if you see one mouse in your house, you have at least a dozen. So far, I've received 3 emails, so there must be a whole bunch more of you in the woodwork. Send your emails or MP3 audio comments to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Our show notes can be found at www.shrinkwrapradio.com. On Skype and Gizmo Project, our name is ShrinkPod. It would be great if you went to the Yahoo podcast directory, the brand new Yahoo podcast directory, and gave us some positive ratings there. Right now we mostly have no ratings at all, so that would be great. We recently had the privilege of meeting podcasters Joe Carpenter and Lori Leahy, who produce a delightful wine podcast, speaking of psychedelics. So stay tuned for their promo right after our musical exit. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave reminding you, it's all in your mind.
A guy.
She's a girl.
And we've got a bottle.
A Guy, a Girl, and a Bottle is a weekly internet radio show for people interested in listening to an innovative wine podcast from a pair of novice wine reviewers.
Join us as we visit and review both the wineries and their wines in and around Silicon Valley.
You can find us in the podcast area of iTunes or on the web at www.gnnb.com.